without ever once ordering a man to put a torch to an Indian home, and no man ever fired a rifle at a native. He had, however, 4 times lost his temper and 2 times threatened to kill. His behavior was erratic and threatening to the future of the expedition. There would be other tribes to encounter, other forms of provocation. Lewis would be tested on his self-control, not his strongest character trait. On April 24th, the expedition marched overland. "Most of the party complain of the soreness of their feet and legs this evening," Lewis recorded. "My left ankle gives me much pain." A cold water foot bath helped. By the 27th, the party reached the country of Chief Yellept and the Walla Wallas, relatives of the Nez Perce. The chief rode up with 6 men and was delighted to see the white men, as they were to see him. Yellept was chief of a village of some 15 lodges with perhaps 150 men and many horses. It was currently set up about 12 miles below the junction of the Columbia and the Snake on the north bank. The captains had promised Yellept the previous October that they would stay a day or two with him on the return journey. He now invited the captains to bring the expedition to his village, where he promised food and horses. A 3-day visit ensued. Yellept set an example for his people by personally bringing wood and fish to the white men. On the 2nd morning, he presented Clark with a very elegant white horse, an act of generosity that lost some of its luster when Yellept indicated he would like a kettle in return. "No kettle," the captain said. "Then whatever they thought proper," Yellept replied. Clark gave him his sword plus 100 balls and powder. Yellept was satisfied. What Yellept did genuinely give away was information. For the first time since they had left the Shoshones, the captains had an interpretive route that allowed them to go beyond the sign language. There was a captive Shoshone woman with the Walla Wallas who could speak to Sacajawea, who could pass it on to Charbonneau, who could communicate with Driard or Labiche, who, finally, could speak to the captains in English. "We conversed with them for several hours," Lewis wrote, "and fully satisfied all their inquiries with respect to ourselves and the objects of our pursuit." In return, Yellep told Lewis of a shortcut to the western end of the Lolo Trail. That evening, Yellep's relatives and neighbors, the Yakimaws, came in at his invitation to see the white men and have a party. There were about 100 men and a few women. Together with the Walla Wallas, they surrounded the white men and waited patiently to see them dance. Crouzat brought out the fiddle, and for an hour the men danced, to the delight of the Indians. Then the Indians, some 550 men, women, and children, sung and danced at the same time. Most of them stood in the same place and merely jumped up to the time of their music. But the bravest men went into the center of the circle and danced in a circular manner sidewise. To the Indians' gratification, some of the white men joined in the dance. This was much different from evenings on the Lower Columbia. On the morning of April 29th, 2 inferior chiefs presented each of the captains with a horse. The gift was welcome, but the return present was expensive. Lewis wrote, "We gave them sundry articles and, among others, one of my case pistols and several 100 rounds of ammunition." That pistol was a highest quality, custom-made weapon, a so-called dueling pistol, kept in a case with accessories, and it was Lewis's personal property, not government issue. The following day, "We took leave of these friendly, honest people, the Walla Wallas, and departed at 11 a.m. The shortcut Yellept told them about took them across the base of the northern bend of the Snake, saving some 80 miles. Thanks to the Walla Wallas, the party had 23 horses, most of them excellent young horses, but much the greater portion of them have sore backs. These Indians are cruel horse masters. They ride hard, and their saddles are so ill constructed. Regardless of this, they ride them when the backs of those poor animals are in a horrid condition." The 2nd night out, 3 teenage Walla Walla boys rode into camp. They were returning a steel trap that had been negligently left behind. Lewis called this an act of integrity rarely witnessed among Indians, without adding that it was also rare among whites, but he praised the Walla Wallas for returning knives carelessly lost by the men. Lewis paid a final tribute to the Walla Wallas. "I think we can justly affirm to the honor of these people that they are the most hospitable, honest, and sincere people that we have met within our voyage." The march the next 2 days was god-awful. The weather was miserable. Rain, hail, and snow with high winds. At dinner on May 3rd, the captains divided the last of the dried meat and the balance of the dogs. We made but a scant supper and had not anything for tomorrow. Their luck held. The next day, the party encountered a band of roving Nez Perce, led by Chief Tito Harsky, the man who had helped Twisted Hair as a guide the previous autumn. He offered to take them to Twisted Hair's village and sold them some roots and fuel. They set off together in the morning. When they reached a village, they tried to purchase provisions without much success, but they discovered that Captain Clark had quite a reputation with these natives as a doctor. It seemed that the previous fall, Clark had washed and then rubbed some liniment on an old Indian man's sore knee and thigh, accompanying the doctoring with what Clark called much ceremony. The man had not walked for months, but recovered with Clark's therapy. Since then, Lewis wrote, this band has never ceased to extol the virtues of our medicines. Together with the effectiveness of the eye water, the Nez Perce had an exalted opinion of our medicine. My friend Captain C is their favorite physician and has already received many applications. The captains could pay for their keep by establishing a hospital. Lewis was a bit disturbed at thus fooling the Indians. He doubted there was much that could be done for most of the complaints, and he was embarrassed to be practicing psychosomatic medicine. He rationalized his way to a justification. In our present situation, I think it pardonable to continue this deception, for they will not give us any provision without compensation. We take care to give them no article which can possibly injure them. In fact, Clark did much good for the Nez Perce. The Indians kept coming because they were benefiting from his therapy. There was no need for Lewis to feel embarrassment. The Indians paid for the therapy with roots and dogs. The dogs were another source of potential embarrassment. The Nez Perce ate horse meat only to ward off starvation and never ate dog. On May 3rd, Lewis related a dog meat anecdote in a piece of concise storytelling. While at dinner, an Indian fellow very impertinently threw a poor, half-starved puppy nearly into my plate by way of derision for our eating dogs and laughed very heartily at his own impertinence. I was so provoked at his insolence that I caught the puppy and threw it with great violence at him and struck him in the breast and face, seized my tomahawk, and showed him by signs if he repeated his insolence, I would tomahawk him. The fellow withdrew, apparently much mortified, and I continued my repast on dog without further molestation. Generally, relations with the Nez Perce were excellent. On May 7th, an Indian rode in with two canisters of powder. His dog had dug them up at the cache the expedition had made in October. The captain rewarded his honesty with a piece of fire-making steel. That day, the Bitterroot Mountains came into view. They were perfectly covered with snow. The Nez Perce gave the captains unfortunate news. The winter snows had been heavy, the snow was yet deep in the mountains, so no passage was possible until early June at best. To men confined to a diet of horse beef and roots, Lewis wrote, and who are as anxious as we are to return to the fat plains of the Missouri and thence to our native homes, this was unwelcome intelligence. The party hated to be stopped. Every day, other than those in winter camp, the men tried to make some progress. Furthermore, beyond those mountains there was tobacco, tools, kettles. On the Missouri plains there were the calves, providing unlimited quantities of tender veal, supplemented by buffalo hump and buffalo tongue, with sausage made by Charbonneau. The captains and their men had been thinking about the upcoming feast for weeks. Now they learned that they would have to stay where they were for 3 weeks, possibly longer, with nothing to eat but dried fish and roots, and when they were lucky, lean elk and deer, or horse meat, or dog. Morale sank. On the morning of May 8th, some of the men ordered out to hunt instead lay about the camp, without our permission or knowledge. The captains found it necessary to chide them severely for their indolence and inattention. That day, the Americans chanced on Chief Cutnose with a party of six. Cutnose had been off on a raid the previous fall, but Lewis had heard of him and knew he was regarded as a greater chief than Twisted Hair. The Indians and white men rode on together and soon encountered Twisted Hair with a half dozen warriors. It was Twisted Hair who had agreed to keep the Americans' horses through the winter. He had been promised 2 guns and ammunition as his reward, and guided the expedition as far down the Snake Columbia as the Dalles. The captains were naturally delighted to see him, but he greeted the white men very coolly. Lewis found this as unexpected as it was unaccountable. Twisted Hair turned to Cut Nose and began shouting and making angry gestures. Cut Nose answered in kind. This continued for some 20 minutes. The captains had no idea what was going on, but clearly they had to break it up. They needed the friendship of both chiefs if they were to get through the next 3 weeks, and they needed their horses if they were to have any chance of getting over the mountains. They informed the chiefs that the expedition was proceeding. The Indians fell in behind, keeping a distance from each other. When the expedition made camp, the 2 chiefs with their little bands formed separate camps at a short distance. They all appeared to be in an ill humor. The captains called for a council. They relied on a Shoshone boy with Cut Nose to interpret for them, but he refused to speak. He alleged it was a quarrel between 2 chiefs and that he had no business with it. For the next hour, the captains could make no sense out of the violent quarrel. They were in an agony of suspense, anxious to reunite with their horses and to keep the Nez Perce as friends. The captains pleaded with the Shoshone boy, but he remained obstinately silent. The chiefs departed for their respective camps, still angry with each other. An hour later, Driar returned from hunting. The captains invited Twisted Hair for a smoke. He accepted, and through Driar explained that when he had returned from the Dalles the previous fall, he had collected the expedition's horses and taken charge of them. Cut Nose then returned from his war party and, according to Twisted Hair, asserted his primacy among the Nez Perce. He said Twisted Hair shouldn't have accepted the responsibility, that it was he, Cut Nose, who should be in charge. Twisted Hair said he got so sick of hearing this stuff that he paid no further attention to the horses, who consequently scattered. But most of them were around, many of them with Chief Broken Arm, who lived upriver and was a chief of great eminence. The captains invited Cut Nose to join the campfire. He came and told us in the presence of the Twisted Hair that he, the Twisted Hair, was a bad old man, that he wore 2 faces. Cut Nose charged that Twisted Hair had never taken care of the horses, but had allowed his young men to ride them and misuse them, and that was the reason Cut Nose and Broken Arm had forbidden him to retain responsibility for the animals. The captain said they would proceed to Broken Arm's camp in the morning and see how many horses and saddles they could collect. This was satisfactory to Twisted Hair and Cut Nose, who had calmed down considerably after being allowed to tell their sides of the story. The next day, everyone moved to Broken Arm's lodge, which was some 150 feet long, built of sticks, mats, and grass. There, the expedition recovered 21 horses, about half the saddles, and some ammunition that had been cached. Lewis paid Twisted Hair 1 gun, 100 balls, and 2 pounds of powder for his services, and said the other promised gun would be delivered when the balance of the horses were brought in. The gun he gave Twisted Hair was an old, beat-up British trading musket, for which he had paid a Chinook 2 elk skins. When the captains explained their supply situation and asked if the Indians would exchange a good but lean horse of theirs for a fat young horse, with a view to slaughter the colt for food, Broken Arm said he was revolted at the idea of an exchange. His people had a great abundance of colts, however, and the white men could have as many as they wanted. He soon produced 2 fat colts and demanded nothing in return. Lewis commented that this was the only act which deserves the appellation of hospitality which we have witnessed in this quarter. Over the next couple of days, various other chiefs joined Cut Nose and Twisted Hair at Broken Arm's lodge. Altogether, the Nez Perce were some 4,000 strong, living in their separate bands, and had by far the largest horse herd on the continent. These chiefs had a constituency that demanded attention. The captains seized their opportunity and held a conference of all the leading men of the Nez Perce. Lewis made a speech. It took nearly half a day for him to get his main points across because the interpretation had to pass through French, Hidatsa, and Shoshone to get to Nez Perce. The main points were peace and harmony among the natives on each side of the Rocky Mountains, the strength and power of the United States, the trading posts that were coming. The captains did not refer to the Nez Perce as their children or to Jefferson as the Indians' new father, but as James Rhonda writes, Thoughts of sovereignty were not far from the Americans' minds. Beyond the American claim to lands west of the Louisiana Purchase, Lewis and Clark had other goals. One was to persuade the Nez Perce to send some guides and diplomats with the expedition to the Blackfoot country. The captain said they would make a peace between the two tribes so that the Nez Perce could come live on the Buffalo side of the Continental Divide and, not incidentally, bring all those horses with them. The captains also wanted one, two, or three chiefs to accompany them back to Washington to meet the president. The chiefs appeared highly pleased with the presentation, but said that they would have to consult among themselves before replying. After the conference, the captains held a magic show, displaying the latest in European and American technology, including a magnet, a spyglass, a compass, a watch, and sundry other articles equally novel and incomprehensible to them. Lewis shot his air gun. The Nez Perce were astonished and impressed. The chiefs then withdrew for their consultation. The next morning, May 12th, the chiefs informed the captains that they had resolved to pursue our advice. To get the power of the people behind the decision, Broken Arm held a sort of plebiscite. He made up a dish of pounded roots and soup, then gave a speech. He announced the decision to do as the Americans wished, then asked all those who were ready to abide by that decision to come forward and eat. Those who opposed would show their sentiments by not eating. "There was not a dissenting voice on this great national question," Lewis wrote, "but all swallowed their objections, if any they had, very cheerfully with their mush." It turned out, however, that what the Nez Perce nation had agreed to do was far short of what the captains had asked. The chief said the people were willing to move east of the mountains, but only after the United States Army had a fort on the Missouri, where they could trade for arms and ammunition to defend themselves. As for a delegate to the Blackfeet, they rather thought not. And as for a delegate to the president, perhaps, maybe, sometime later. The Nez Perce concluded by warning the captains it was too early even to think about crossing the mountains. The captains could think of little else. "We are anxious to procure some guides to accompany us on the different routes we mean to take from Traveler's Rest," Lewis wrote. Lewis did most of the smoking and talking with the chiefs, while Clark practiced medicine. Every morning, his patients lined up for treatment. He used eyewash, hot rubdowns, and simples for sore eyes, scrofula, tuberculosis of the lymph glands, ulcers, rheumatism, and other ailments. One case was particularly difficult. An old chief had been suffering from paralysis for 3 years. "He was incapable of moving a single limb," Lewis reported, "but lies like a corpse in whatever position he is placed. Yet he eats heartily, digests his food perfectly, enjoys his understanding, his pulse are good, and has retained his flesh almost perfectly." Nothing Clark tried on him seemed to do any good. Among the party, Bratton was still suffering from his bad back. Sacagawea's son, Jean-Baptiste, in addition to teething, had a high fever and a swollen neck and throat. The captains gave him some tartar and sulfur and applied a poultice of boiled onions to his neck, as hot as he could stand it. The therapy did no good. A few days later, Lewis wrote that the boy was very restless last night. Its jaw and the back of its neck are much more swollen. We gave it a dose of cream of tartar and applied a fresh poultice of onions. Clark had better results with Bratton. At Private John Shields' suggestion, Clark prescribed a sweat bath for Bratton. A sweat lodge was built, stones were heated up and placed inside. Bratton went in naked with a vessel of water to sprinkle on the stones to make steam, and after 20 minutes he was taken out and plunged into cold water. Then back to the sweat lodge. Within a day, Bratton was walking, free from pain for the first time in months. Sacagawea's boy slowly recovered, but the paralyzed chief showed no improvement. Lewis regretted that he was not back in Philadelphia, where Benjamin Franklin had experimented with electricity to treat paralytic cases. "I am confident that this chief would be an excellent subject for electricity," Lewis wrote on May 27th. Instead of shock therapy, the captains decided on heat therapy. They built a sweat lodge for the chief and put him in, fortified with 30 drops of laudanum for relaxation. It worked. The chief regained the use of his hands and arms, and soon his leg and toes. "He seems highly delighted with his recovery," Lewis wrote on May 30th. "I began to entertain strong hope of his restoration by these sweats." The medical practice was critical to maintaining a continuing food supply, but by itself insufficient. The men needed more food than Clark's fees could provide. They had nothing in the way of trade goods, so it was down to the clothes off their backs, the buttons off their coats and pants. When the men discovered that brass buttons were an article of which these people are tolerably fond, the men cut off all their buttons to trade for roots. Never ask your men to do something you won't do yourself is time-honored advice to company commanders. In this case, the captains cut the buttons from their dress coats a few days later, which brought in 3 bushels of roots. "A successful voyage," Lewis said of the trading venture, "not much less pleasing to us than the return of a good cargo to an East India merchant." On May 21st, the captains took a drastic step. They decided that each man should make his own deal for roots sufficient to get him over the Bitterroots. Each man got 1 awl, 1 knitting pin, 1/2 ounce of vermilion, 2 needles, a few skeins of thread, and about 1 yard of ribbon. Lewis called it a slender stock indeed with which to lay in a store of provision for that dreary wilderness. He comforted himself with the thought that they could fall back on horse meat. The expedition's herd was growing, thanks to Clark's doctoring, and by the beginning of June was up to 65 horses. The long wait with the Nez Perce gave Lewis an opportunity to do more ethnography. He described the tribe's dress and ornaments at some length. He judged the Nez Perce to be cheerful but not gay. Their young men were fond of gambling and gay.